The Gadget Guy on Cambridge 105 Radio with the Centre for Computing History, Cambridge. Making the history of computing fun for everyone. Visit computinghistory.org.uk to find out more.
And welcome to show number 269, where we'll be looking at dash cams for your car and possibly for use on two wheels as well.
That's plus the latest technology news. Welcome to the Gadget Guide. It's time to take a look at this week's technology news. We'll start off with a little bit of crossover from the musical world, but mostly talking about Apple, because they've been hit by a rather significant fine by the European Union. And this is over it's what's called anti-steering provisions. And the idea is that normally if you sell something for the iPhone or the iPad or even the Mac through Apple's App Store, Apple get a 30% cut of that for providing the App Store service. And of course, app manufacturers don't want to hand that 30% over to Apple. Apple don't want the app manufacturers to walk away and do their own thing and not give them the 30%, which is all fine when you're paying for an application. Where it gets a bit trickier is when you're paying for a service. So something like Spotify, because Spotify are pretty keen that you just pay them your $12.99 a month or whatever it is. Nowadays, outside of the App Store, keeping all of that themselves, Apple have tried to argue that that's against their terms and conditions and put requirements in that basically say on the Apple platforms, you cannot advertise that it's cheaper for somebody to go and subscribe directly. And therefore, you have to charge the same price whether you buy it through the App Store or elsewhere. That has now been struck down as anti-competitive, unfair trading conditions by the European Commission. And of course, this is potentially a significant loss of revenue for Apple, not just for via Spotify, but also a whole load of other similar service platforms.
It won't be long before Amazon start looking at it and going, does that mean we can start talking Kindle about how books. You can buy Kindle books?
Yep.
Sites that sell downloadable digital movies and TV series.
And to be clear, I don't think there's any likelihood in the near term, at least, that you're going to be able to buy your Kindle books within the Kindle for iOS application directly without handing over that 30%. But what it does mean is that Amazon, taking it as an example, might be able to say, hey, it's cheaper if you go over to this website here.
Or allowed to include a link that runs an open Safari to an Amazon page where you can then buy the book, or to, you know, ITVX to buy a box set of a British production that's not available on the Apple TV library. All of those interesting things. Of course, the news of this did affect Apple in the markets, and their share price was quite badly hit when the news broke and the markets opened in the US. They were down 3% after news of the fine, which doesn't sound like a lot until you work out what their market capitalization is.
Yes.
3% is $80 billion worth of market capitalization.
Now, I suspect that this is going to be a reasonably transient hit.
Yes.
I suspect that's going to rebound very quickly,
if
indeed it hasn't already. But nonetheless, it is showing a bit of a knock in confidence. I'm not sure how much of Apple's kind of revenue comes from App Store purchases and the commission on those. I'm guessing it's a reasonably large chunk, but it's not entirely clear how much that's going to be affected by this decision, because the likes of Amazon, you already can't buy Kindle books through that platform. They just don't signpost it. You have to go to the Amazon website and know that you have to do that.
Apple's revenue from iTunes software and services for Q1 2024 exceed $20 billion.
I guess as a proportion
proportion of the whole, not sure.
Yep.
Not sure.
Yeah, so an interesting one, and it's something that's been rumbling on for quite some time. I think we talked about it a few weeks ago as well.
Yeah.
Of course, the obvious next question is, this is Apple. Google, not a massive dissimilar practice with the Play Store.
Yeah, and I think they will be very carefully watching this and deciding whether they quietly turn around to the likes of Spotify and Amazon and say, you know what we said?
Yep.
we're changing our mind, because changing our mind could save us a couple of billion euros.
Yeah, and of course the other question here is this is a European Union decision. It's part of or come out of the Digital Markets Act. That, of course, only affects EU countries. Will we see this policy change if it does end up in a change in policy on Apple's part? Will we see that change across the globe, or will it only be something that happens in EU markets? Will we sort of benefit from this change potentially in the UK? And of course, our American colleagues will be wondering much the same thing. So,
as well as their nearest neighbours, the Canadians will probably be going, and what's going to happen now?
Yeah, exactly. No, it could be that other countries look at the lead that the EU has taken and decide to implement similar legislation. But as it stands, Apple are only going to be compelled to act on this within the EU.
Yep. Sticking with Spotify, since they sort of got in the spotlight a little bit, interesting news from Spotify in the US at the moment only. They have launched a new subscription tier of $9.99 without music.
Now, this is intriguing because, of course, Spotify were very well known for starting out as the music streaming service. Of course, rather more than that now, because you also get podcasts, you get audiobooks, that sort of thing. And so it's fascinating to see them advertising a thing which is their service minus the bit they originally set out to do. Yeah. But of course, they are a huge platform for those other areas.
Yeah, 200,000 plus audiobooks in their library. And the $10 subscription gets you 15 hours of listening a month across that entire library. You don't have to buy them. It's effectively streaming like you would any TV program. But 15 hours, which sounds like a lot until you look at how long you can spend listening to an audiobook. So, you've got to weigh that up. And, of course, their biggest competitor that they are targeting actively is Amazon with the Audible service.
And I was just searching quickly for how much the current Audible subscription is. That's $7.99 a month in the UK. So, yeah, very similar to that $10 a month. The Spotify are targeting that subscription at. I suspect that's no great surprise.
Yeah. Audible subscription in the US, they've got a $15 subscription which gets you one complete book in the month. Now, audiobooks tend to be multiple hours, in fact, into tens of hours, depending on the book. So, 15 hours a month might not even complete a book, depending on the book that you're going for. If you went for something like War and Peace, it's not going to be finished in 15 hours. Think about the poor reader who had to read that for you.
Yeah, very true.
Whether this will cross the pond or not remains to be seen. Obviously, Audible feature in a lot of markets as well as the US.
Yeah, it's. I've always found the suppressing of the audiobook service is a little bit interesting because on the one hand we're so used to services like Spotify and YouTube Music where you pay somewhere around the £10 a month and get an effectively all-you-can-eat service. And then you have the likes of Audible and now Spotify coming in at a similar price point for a very much more limited number of hours. Mm. If you're someone who has maybe an hour a day commuting time and you listen to audiobooks, you're going to chomp through that 15 hours
quickly. Disappears in a week, yes.
On the other hand, I guess where they're anchoring it is if I were to go and buy either the paper books or the Kindle books, then that isn't an all-you-can-eat service, unless, of course, you go down to your local library. If you were to buy a physical book rather than an audiobook, you'd obviously be expecting to pay per book.
But then Amazon have got Kindle Unlimited to get you that all-you-can-eat option. So, these things are very interesting on how the digital delivery of content is changing the way we consume things. Anyway, moving on to Apple again. So moving back to Apple, but this time new stuff that they are obviously hoping will do well in the market. Shiny, shiny new hardware. Firstly, their new MacBooks, their MacBook Air 13-inch and 15-inch with the M3 CPU. That's their latest chip, which they're saying is about 60% faster than the Model M1. Not a major jump from the M2. But there are a lot of savings in terms of power budget, so it uses less battery power, so you can run it longer, and quite a lot of stuff around optimizing graphics and also the new machine learning ideas that we're throwing into compute.
Yes, and it's good to see the choice of size, I have to say, because for some people, 13-inch laptops are just right. You know, they're pretty transportable, and of course the MacBook Air was always designed to be that kind of small, light, thin device that you could use anywhere. But at the same time, there's some folks that do appreciate that larger screen size. Maybe your eyesight isn't entirely perfect, and having that larger screen is really valuable. So it's good to see
your large spreadsheets or the photos and videos you're editing. You just get more advantage of that screen real estate.
Absolutely, but it means, whereas before the current generation MacBook Airs have that choice of screen size as well. But before that generation, if you wanted that 15-inch screen, you were forced onto the MacBook Pro, and that is not a cheap option. The MacBook Pro 15 inches, you're looking often north of £2,000.
There are a few advantages of the Pro series. I mean, the Air is a great bit of hardware, and with the lid closed, you can have two external displays attached to it, two 4K displays.
And that is new.
And the Pro allows four displays, so you can really go large amount of screen real estate if that's what your workflow actually benefits from. Apparently from Friday you'll be able to walk into an Apple store and either order or pre-order one. So whether there'll be stock in the Grand Arcade or not sure, but that is what they are saying. So available in their regular colorways, Midnight, Starlight, Silver, and the Space Gray is, I think that was new last year, across the range.
Very good. It's not the only product that's being launched soon, because we're also expecting to see a range of other things, not least a new series of iPads, iPad Pros and iPad Airs. The Pros coming with a new screen technology. They're going OLED, which is a bit of tech that we're utterly used to seeing in mobile phones, and have been for some years now. Very good power consumption, very good contrast ratio, so the sort of light to dark ratio. But now we're starting to see that in the larger screens of the iPad Pros, those also benefiting from the latest M3 chip. So, actually, similar processor lineup to the MacBook Airs. But there's also the iPad Airs, which are the lighter ones, now available in a larger screen format as well.
Yes, not a complete overlap with the Pro, obviously. It's got the M2 chip in the Air, and there'll also be a new 10.9-inch as well as the 12.9-inch. So you'll still be able to get something that's, almost fitted into a large pocket, as well as the, looks like a large book in your hand. Whether there'll be some new accessories, there's rumours about new Magic Keyboards. Of course, they did refresh the Apple Pencil recently as well, to include, of course, on a lot of these things, USB-C.
Interesting, yes. And again, that was something that originally came out of the EU decision, that all portable electronic devices that were rechargeable needed to use the USB-C connector. That moved us away from the interesting combination of lightning on Apple devices, USB, micro USB, USB-C, mini USB, and a dozen proprietary standards that we had before. So now pretty much everything is going USB-C, which
proprietary, and I'm going to hold it up because it belongs to a dash cam, which we'll get to a bit, and Rob is going to cringe because it looks like a headphone jack plug, but it's a power plug.
Oh, no. Don't do it. Don't do it.
There's a reason for it, and we'll come to that later. Staying in the Apple world, iOS 17.4, the latest version of the operating system for your iPhone, should be, if not already on your phone, relatively soon will be available for you to install. Bunch of new features, including better standby, more customization, newer messaging features, things that were supposed to come into iOS 17.0 but didn't make it in, have managed to finally get all the way up to 17.4.
Now, I have to say, as usual, with 17.4 includes a bunch of security updates, and so if your device is eligible, you should go and install that, even if you don't care about the new shiny features. But there's a slight bit of confusion I can see going around at the moment, which is that for older devices that can't run iOS 17, they seem to still be getting updates, but there were a couple of interesting bugs in Mobile Safari that only seem to have been fixed in iOS 17 point something. So even though your iOS 16 device is still getting updates, they might not necessarily fix everything. And Apple aren't being too clear about exactly what the story is there. So do watch out. I think it's something like back to the iPhone 12. I think you can get iOS 17. So do that update if it is available. And if you're on an older device, make sure you're on the most recent version that is available to you.
Yeah, I mean, even looking on Apple's website, trying to find out what is released and supported. But if I do scroll through all the iPhones, iOS 17, all the way back to the XS and XS Max, if you remember those, which came after the 8.
So yes.
The iPhone 8 and 7 are up so to the, iOS
So the
16.
X is not. The iPhone X is not, but the subsequent models are.
Is equivalent to 8 in terms of support, so iOS 16 supported on those, and still some security updates coming out for that. So don't throw away your iPhone 8 just yet. You know, it's still got, if it's still in good condition, keep using it as long as you can. Your challenge will be when things like your banking app says this operating system is out of date.
Yes.
And we can't vouch for the security of your money. Interesting, one of the features in 17.4, and this is another EU bashing Apple, one is that you'll be able to replace Apple Pay with a third-party payment app.
Interesting. I did see someone, presumably off the back of this, mentioning that one of their frustrations with Android, which of course is sort of Google developed, but the Android operating system itself is open source, is that whilst you can replace most bits of Google stuff with other things, Google Pay at the moment is the only payment provider supported on Android, I think.
On Samsung devices, you can use Samsung Pay.
Interesting.
So Samsung, I think, yeah. Because Samsung worked with Google on the fingerprint and the NFC technologies and handed that IP back to Google to incorporate into Android, I think they've got an arrangement. And yes, you can replace Samsung Pay with Google Pay, so you can pick between, but you have a bit more choice on the Galaxies, maybe more on the Galaxy than on the Pixels, not sure about OnePlus.
Maybe that's what it is, yeah.
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 So yes, bunch of new features. Go for the update as soon as it hits your phone.
Very good. Heading into the gaming world and Steam, we seem to sort of run this story every few months. Steam has hit, guess what, a new record, over 34 million concurrent users. And yeah, it's all the big games that you'd expect, Counter-Strike 2, Dota 2, PUBG, Apex Legends, Helldivers 2. Yeah, all of those are the reason that we're seeing this, although Steam has this massive long tail of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands.
So they reckon that on Sunday the 3rd of March, 11.1 million users were actively playing a game, 34.6 million users were logged in, possibly browsing and trying to decide what game to play. It's almost become as bad as when you sit down and start your streaming TV service and go, what are we going to watch? And 20 minutes later you haven't picked something. It can get like that with Steam as well.
Yep, of course, Palworld, which we also talked about last time on the Gadget Guide, that's now up to 250,000 concurrent players as part of that total. So,
Wow. Yeah,
for a relatively small title from not one of the major gaming studios,
and that's literally aged in weeks still.
Yeah, we're talking, what's that, a quarter? Yeah, that's something like 1%, nearly 1% of Steam's concurrent online users are playing Palworld.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Sticking with gaming and moving over to Sony and consoles, and Sony have filed a patent for a new PlayStation DualSense controller. Which is quite interesting because patents have to be filed to protect your intellectual property way before you start making something. But they give very big clues to a lot of people as to what you're actually going to be making. Obviously, no one can copy it at that point directly because they'll infringe your patent. But it also means that accessory manufacturers can start making things like cases for phones, like extra batteries for things that take batteries. The stuff that's come out that is in Sony's patent is a feature which could allow a weighted component which allows the controller to shift the center of mass as you are playing.
Interesting. So this is obviously the kind of next step from the haptic feedback.
Yep. And, you know, the vibration. Not just to vibrate, but yes, exactly. As you're steering to the right-hand side gets heavier.
And that is going to be super interesting. And things like driving games, you can totally imagine that being a feature of things like a steering wheel or a yoke or something like that, similarly flight games. But yeah, it's just another step, particularly if you combine that in due course with some kind of virtual reality of making things feel more immersive and yeah, more realistic as well. I suspect that we'll see a lot of very interesting uses, particularly if that can move quickly, because it means you can move away from a vibration, which at the simplest is just it either vibrates or it doesn't, to sort of things almost feeling blobby or watery or that sort of thing.
If they you already shift have this thing around. The adjustability in the control so that basically the game can make the triggers and the game controls feel stickier and harder to push based on what's going on. You know, you go underwater in the game and suddenly the buttons are harder to push.
Yeah, but yeah, moving that to the whole controller trying to move around in your hands, I think it's going to be very interesting. Of course, it's not just the patents that we get to see. It's also things like filings with the FCC, the US communications regulator, because those have to have almost teardowns of the electronics inside these products.
And again, all the Bluetooth and the Wi-Fi works inside the device.
That can give some real clues to what's going on.
Yes, into new software that might have come to a device that you own already. And this is Google TV has had an upgrade. So if you've got a Google Chrome with Google TV, or if you just use the Google TV app on various devices like Chromebooks and phones, it's been overhauled and improved. Certainly on the Chromecast, the GUI is nicely cleaned up. They've done a fair amount of polishing of the graphical user interface. Things like your apps are now in roundels rather than sort of blobby, squarish type things with slightly rounded corners. So they've gone round for those, which look quite pretty. You can also finally reorder your apps in the row, so you can actually change the order and put your favorite ones closer to the start of the screen. More importantly, on the usability side, for people who use headphones with their Chromecast for Google with Google TV, better Bluetooth support and pairing for headphones.
Nice. And that's definitely something I found myself. I'm currently using which one of it is the Chromecast, but not the one with Google TV. Mm-hmm. And that works fine. But I would love it if I could use my Bluetooth headphones with. Yeah, whilst watching things on my TV or on my projector without having to have that cable.
Dump up for a Chromecast with Google TV.
I think so. When's the next Black Friday deals or something like that?
You probably find there'll be some sales from Google around Google I.O., which is normally May, so you might only have a couple of months to wait for some offers from Google. But saying that, there's also the possibility of them releasing a new Chromecast device. There have been some filings with the likes of the FCC on things, and also code has been spotted in the Android stack relating to something that is not the current Chromecast, but something newer. So, you know, we could see new hardware, which will mean that the existing Chromecast with Google TV will probably go down in price. They are still very capable devices, even though they've been around for about 3 or 4 years now, because they are fully 4K capable. And yeah, the biggest drawbacks I think they've got is the amount of storage you've got for installing more apps. And yeah, you know, the CPU is now 3 to 4 years old, so possibly not as slick as a current generation Snapdragon could be.
Yeah, very good. Where else should we head? Oh, yes, so DVDs. Well, yes, they're still a thing. I do still use them for watching films.
Or Blu-ray.
Or Blu-rays. Because I still like the fact that once I've got one of those on my bookshelf, then
no one can go, this title has been removed from your service.
Exactly, yeah. For there are some series and some films that I will watch again and again.
Yeah.
And so I do still like owning that media. Obviously, they're a lot less frequently used as they were a few years ago. But that might be changing because we're starting to see research on optical discs that could store up to 200 terabytes of data. So to put that in context, I think a Blu-ray is somewhere around 50 gigabytes.
It's about 21 times a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
No, sorry. 4,000 times a Blu-ray. About 21 times your average top-end laptop hard drive.
And that is an insane amount of data. It is pretty much at the stage of you can back up your lifetime's current media and everything else like that onto one disk. Of course, make sure you don't then misplace that disk. But it does mean that for this particularly archival data storage, we've got this huge step forward in data density.
Absolutely. And what they're saying is that where you might have a big data center that occupies a footprint the size of your average football stadium, and these do exist, you know, where do you think your Facebook photos get stored and your YouTube cat videos? Condensing that down to the size of a small room, that's the sort of data reduction we're talking about, the technology getting to that level. Obviously, we're years away from this becoming something that a data center will be able to go, well, that rack of equipment has now got all of our whizzy new optical storage, which stores a whole lot of stuff. But we're talking, the interesting thing is the idea of 3D storage. So we're storing layers of information on the disk, not just one or two layers like we used to, but up to 100 layers in the disk.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, there you go. Lots more data storage coming soon-ish to a data center near you. Next up, though, we'll be talking about dash cams. Which ones do you want? Why do you want one? And what to look out for?
105. Cambridge 105 Radio. Wednesdays on Cambridge 105 Radio, Queer Cambridge. Mary, Kate and Ellie have topical discussion from the LGBTQ community. A look at queer news nationally and locally, and events you can get involved in. Queer Cambridge, Wednesday at 6 on Cambridge 105 Radio, and available now at cambridge105.co.uk.
In need of legal advice you can trust? Woodfine Solicitors offers a range of expert and award-winning legal services, whatever your problem. Perhaps you've been a victim of crime, or maybe you or a loved one have been involved in the criminal justice system. Woodfines can help ensure that you get the right representation. Our defence team are available 24/7, and we're upfront and transparent about our costs. Find out more at woodfines.co.uk and arrange a no-obligation chat. Woodfines. Cutting through the red tape.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Where you're listening to The Gadget Guide with Robin Lawrence, and we're going to be talking now about dash cams. So, first of all, why might you want a dash cam?
So, we first talked about dash cams about 9 years ago. And, of course, technology has improved quite a lot. I'm sure that by now everyone has seen at least one dash cam video online of someone doing something daft. Yeah, so
we'll
they're not just
that in a second.
Not just for capturing that, but you know, peace of mind, insurance. You know, the first thing your insurance company asks you when you have an accident these days is, do you have dash cam footage?
Yeah, and that's both the insurance company and in some cases the police forces.
Yep. Safety. So, you know, if you're traveling through areas where you do feel unsafe, maybe it increases your safety, your feeling of safety, and security. A lot of dash cams these days can be left running while your car's parked and not using the car's battery. They'll have their own battery supply to effectively capture things happening to your car while you're not near your car. So, you know, the hit and run accidents, someone trying to nick your car, someone maliciously damaging your car, all those sort of things can be caught on camera, which
and
will
in some
help
cases,
your insurance claims.
Yeah, we'll come on to this in a sec, because in some cases you can watch them remotely even when you're not in the car as well. So maybe if you parked it when you go on holiday or something like that. Of course, it can just be a sort of a nostalgia thing. You know, if you do go travelling, maybe you go away on holiday, and you just want to recount those memories, store the
well, if
the
you've got a favourite scenic drive, you know, if you were doing a drive through the Alps, having a dash cam to relive that footage of the sweeping roads, the vistas, the large mountains with snow on top, and then being able to show it to friends and family. You know, this is where I've been. Here's my dash. You're obviously not going to bore them, hopefully, with hours of footage. But, you know, you can show them highlights of your trip.
Yeah, and certainly I've done that. I'm thinking even all the way back to 2012. I went to South Africa for a few days, and there are some fantastic roads. And back then, just having one of the, I think the GoPro 2. What number are we up to now? About 14 or something.
Something like that.
And yeah, even then, to be able to show that to my parents and the like when we got back was really interesting. Of course, you mentioned at the start that, you know, you do get videos on social media of people sharing stuff that has happened to them when they're out driving or cycling or even walking around. And we need to be a little bit careful about that because GDPR, which is data protection regulations, originally designed by the when we were in the EU, but also since transplanted into UK law as well, it's got this neat personal domestic use exception. So if you're doing it for your own safety to show your holiday snaps to your family, that's fine. You don't need to do anything. You can totally use it for that. Once you start maybe sharing it on social media, particularly if you're monetizing that, that starts to get into very shaky ground if there are other people identifiable those videos.
YouTube will certainly honor a request if someone says, Rob's posted a picture of me while I was on the road and Rob's dash cam, and he's posted online. I can go to YouTube and I can say, this video with me in it, I object to. And YouTube will turn around to Rob and go, Rob, you need to either blur Lawrence out or take the video down. But we've turned off monetizing straight away. Yeah. So it will be demonetized for a start straight away as soon as there's a complaint. Yeah, think twice about sharing.
Yeah, even before there's a complaint, you know, just because it'll take, you know, YouTube and other platforms will help take it down. Yeah, you know, doesn't mean it's okay if nobody complains. Yeah. Of course, if you proactively make sure that nobody is identifiable in that, then that's fine.
Yeah, you, and I think
you're,
you know,
perfectly
someone
entitled to film in public. It's when people become identifiable.
Yeah,
and start,
I think someone cutting you up in their clapped-out banger. Yeah,
blur the registration plate.
Well, the registration plate isn't an identifier of the driver. It's an identifier of the registered keeper who might not be the driver at that time. So
true.
That gets
I
a little bit
good
grayer.
Luck, good luck making that argument. I think I'd probably take the registration plate out if I was you.
Yes. So features of dash cams you might want to look at. Obviously, front-facing makes the most sense for most people, but you might want something that includes a rear-facing camera as well. What that's going to catch is the tailgaters, the rear-enders, you've just run over something and you've damaged your car. Obviously, if it was something just like an object in the road that damaged your car, you want the evidence of approaching it, being unable to avoid it, and seeing it behind you. Things like potholes are a good example these days. So front and rear facing, ideally they are one system so that the system, as it's recording, is recording the two synchronized together.
Yes, and that means you do get that sort of, okay, it's gone under the car or gone past the car, and then you see it pop out the back immediately. So yeah, having that time synchronization. On the time sync, by the way, do make sure if you get a dash cam that you set the clock correctly.
Yes.
Because I had a colleague who recorded an incident of road rage, provided it to the police, and they said, this is a bit of a problem because you didn't set the clock and it says 1970 or whatever the default time was. Now, clearly it wasn't 1970 because we didn't have 4K dash cams back in 1970 and he's clearly driving a modern car. But the advice he was given was that its evidential value was substantially impacted by not having the correct date and time showing. So
now,
do make sure you set that.
A lot of these dash cams will have an app on your phone for you to be able to view footage, download it, and so on. And hopefully that will also help you set the clock a lot easier. So acquiring a dash cam. Now, a lot of manufacturers are now offering dash cams as an option when you buy a car. And it can be a second hand, not just a new. Certainly it's available in the catalogue of a lot of companies in their options sections, options and accessories of probably in the security section of dash cams, where basically you'll buy your car and it'll be pre-installed, which means all the wiring will be pristine. You won't see any trace of it being installed. But a lot of them can do that on second-hand cars as well. So think about that if you're buying a car from a main dealer. Of course, some manufacturers like Tesla have got just, you know, 400 cameras around the side of the every side of the car, videoing all the time. So it's built into the system.
I do suspect that we're going to start seeing this as a feature on more and more cars. It's like they've got the cameras anyway because they're using them for speed limit detection and you know, parking assistance and stuff like that. It's not a great leap to use those same cameras for dash cam functionality. On the flip side, I suspect that's going to be seen as a monetization option, and it's going to be pay another £10 a month if you want to be able to get your dash cam footage out of the car.
Yes, like certain manufacturers charge for heated seats as a subscription. Resolution, I think we can probably put to bed. I don't think you should be buying anything that isn't, these days, 1080p. I would avoid the 720p's, the original standard of high definition. We've long exceeded high definition at 720p. 1080p is going to give you all of the detail that you need to have for proper evidence purposes, even if it's just being able to read the number plate of the car that's departing from a hit and run against your car. You want
to make sure that it stays good quality, particularly in the dark, because it's pretty easy to make a good quality camera in bright sunshine. Make sure you also get that image quality you're looking for when it's dark and raining and horrible out there. That's when you're probably going to need it the most.
Yeah, 4K, of course, top end. Go for it if it's inside your budget. Most of the manufacturers have done away with putting a screen in them because of apps and attached apps that way. So there's less distraction these days from dash cams. I'd avoid one with a screen anyway. It's a bit more of a gimmick than anything else. You're never going to be able to see evidentiary data on a little screen that's only 2 inches across.
Yeah.
Sensors included in them. Most of them include a GPS these days so that it can record on your footage the latitude and longitude of where you are, which is very useful for you.
And also your speed. If you can get the speed off of your GPS, then as long as you are sticking to the speed limit, which of course you should, then that is going to be more evidence, particularly if it's an insurance claim or something like that, that you were operating the vehicle within the, you know, within the law at the time of the incident. Of course,
Do be aware, you can self-incriminate yourself with the evidence of your dash cam. If you provided your dash cam saying, I've got this footage of Rob doing something stupid, and you hand it over to the police and they look at it and they go, but you were speeding, we're prosecuting you for speeding.
Yep.
And you can effectively self-prosecute yourself that way. So do be aware of that. That is entirely within the scope of the law.
Yeah, make sure that you're being sensible before using this footage.
So options. I think one of the most commonly known places, household names, where you could go and get a dash cam and have a bloke fit it for you pretty much straight away is Halfords.
A good
range generally in shop. And fitting services. You do have to book. You can't necessarily go, I'm going to walk in and someone's going to fit it for me this afternoon. You do have to make sure that they have got a slot available for the person who knows how to fit it in your type of car to do the job.
Yep. And if we look at some simple systems, so things like the single camera ones, something like the Nextbase, that's going to start just over the £50 mark and go up to maybe the higher quality, higher end models around about the kind of £150, £200 mark. So,
that's a front facing only.
Yep. Not necessarily a huge amount of money. Do add a little bit more for that fitting service if you don't want to do it yourself, though.
Yes. Now that you can move up to the higher end ones, which have got the front and back camera. So the cheapest I found on Halfords' website was a Rode Angel Halo View 2K. So that's 1440p, so still slightly better than 1080p. Anti-glare front and rear dash cam for £100. Marked down at the moment, half price. So that's a pretty good deal. The next cheapest I could find that was two cameras that wasn't heavily discounted was up to about £160, £170. So we were suddenly getting a little bit more expensive there as we got into the dual camera systems.
Now, if you don't want to take your car to a shop and wait for them to fit it, then there's a couple of manufacturers. So Nextbase, who we just mentioned for those single camera systems, but also Blackview for the dual cam systems. Both of those offer the option of home installation. Now, this doesn't come ever so cheap. Nextbase, their standalone home fitting is £120 at the moment, and that means it's pretty much coming on for the cost of the camera. Nonetheless,
depending on which camera you're going for, of course.
Yeah, maybe a very convenient option.
The advantages of getting a professional to install it is, A, they'll know how to do your car because they'll have done that type of car before. They'll know where the power is available to wire in power. They'll know how to run the wiring neatly around the windscreen so you can't see the wiring. Same for the back camera. They'll know how to get the wiring from, certainly if you've got a hatchback, how to get the wiring from the window through that little bit of rubber that all of the cables go through with all your brake lights and so on, and the washer fluid. They'll know how to get the cable through there, run it through all the rubbers so that you'll never see any of the wiring for it, which is an advantage.
This also means they can go straight into the car's fuse box and mean that you're not having to plug things into your cigarette lighter socket or anything like that.
Makes it more difficult for anyone to nick your dash cam because, yes, that is
true,
a thing.
Yes.
People do steal dash cams that aren't fully installed. So if you've just got something on a suction mount, it is thievable, sadly. And of course, they will then guarantee and warranty the installation and their dash cam that they have fitted if you're buying their own dash cam. Other options for fitting, the RAC do fitting. They obviously sell as well. So if you have an RAC membership, you might be able to take advantage of that because they'll give you 10% off in their shop. And I think they give you a discount on the installation as well, which is quite good. And locally in Cambridge, you've got CBS Automotive. They're just up the A10, who do dash cam sales and installation as well. And you can literally pop in there and chat to the guys about options. They'll be able to talk to you about what they've got. If you're going for a front and rear with battery, they reckon it's 3 to 4 hours install. So think about that. If you were doing it yourself, that's someone who knows what they're doing. You're probably going to need all day to do it because you've got to get those wires through all of those rubbers and make it look tidy afterwards.
Of course, it's not just cars that can use dash cams. Okay, maybe less of a dash and more of the cam. If you're a keen cyclist, then we're seeing an increasing number of cyclists riding with cameras on. Various ways of mounting these. Helmets is the kind of the most common. And I've seen some really good videos from people using the 360-degree cameras. So these are the ones which use a few lenses. And it means that after you've taken your footage, you can then get back home and scroll around. So it's like, what was that I just went past? Or what was that happened off to my left? And you can decide which way the camera points after the fact, which is really useful because often if you're on a bike, there's more going on than just what's in front of you and what's directly behind you. You're much more interested if someone sort of strayed into the cycle lane, perhaps, and tried to clip you from the side.
Yes. So most cycling reviewers and magazines say action cameras are a great starting point. The GoPros, the Insta360s, that's that one that'll give you that panoramic view, or even the cheap GoPro clones. You know, do bear in mind that a lot of them are less likely to be waterproof, which is something that's possibly quite important when you're out cycling in British weather.
It depends if you're a bit of a fair weather cyclist like me, then then anything should be good.
If you are going for cameras, one thing that a lot of them say worth considering is consider a rear camera. So that can see those tailgatings, the person coming up and being road radio aggressive behind you. And Techologic do a CR1 rear light with HD camera. So it's a light as well as a camera for £100.
Interesting.
Combo packs are quite an interesting thought, and a crowd called Innov, INNOVV, their K6 dual lens camera system. So it's a front and rear fixed camera mounted on your handlebars and on the back under your seat, £230. Sounds like an expensive system. Top grade output from that. If you are cycling all the time, that might be something of an advantage. Otherwise, as you said, helmet cams, and Techologic again do the DC1 dual lens helmet camera for £190. It's got a front and forward facing camera at the same time.
Oh, nice.
So it's filming behind you and in front of you at the same time.
Yeah, and just cool. On a single mount, and it can either go on the top of your helmet or off to the side, which is rather nice. Do be a little bit careful if you're a cyclist mounting things on your helmet. Obviously, if you are involved in an accident, you don't want the camera to be getting in the way and doing damage to you.
Yes.
So often the mounts that are designed for this are designed to break away, get the camera out the way, and let the helmet protect your head.
And very briefly onto motorcycles, the same idea: don't mount cameras to your helmet if you can help it. A handlebar mounted camera is going to be safer for you, more secure, and you can probably wire it into power as well so that it can actually last longer for you. The inner range available for motorcycles as well. Another one to look at is the Drift Ghost series, who do a very good range of effectively action cameras designed for motorcycles with all of the necessary brackets to make them secure. Interestingly, they do, instead of a chest mount, they do a shoulder mount. So you basically put on a strappy thing which mounts the camera on your shoulder, looking in the direction, so it's in a safe location instead of your helmet.
Very good. Next gadget guide, we'll be talking about air fryers and other new kitchen technology.
Cambridge 105 Radio.